welcome to the June 8th, 2023 edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I am Anthony Bardaway, and while I am alone for this intro section, we will soon be getting into an interview with Dylan Burns of Dylan Burns TV on YouTube and Twitch, a political streamer, content creator, and a war journalist who is on the ground and has been doing some good reporting. But before we can get into an interview, I'd be remiss not to mention some of the major headlines of the week. I'm, of course, first and foremost talking about Russia causing the destruction of the Kakhovka Dam, the dam which is immediately to the north of Kherson City at Novokakhovka. While if you remember our episodes from the Kherson offensive, we kind of gave an explanation of this being a possibility that if Russia decided to destroy the dam, that it would wipe out many of the towns and villages, especially on the eastern bank of the Dnipro River, while Kherson City itself would, to a large extent, be saved from it due to the center and many of the neighborhoods being at a higher elevation. But on the Russian occupied side of things, which is all lowland, apparently the Russians destroyed people's boats so they cannot get out. They are not allowing anyone to leave the area unless they have a Russian passport. And considering that many of these people will be elderly, the number of people who are drowned outright is staggering, although we don't know how many yet. And who knows if they did survive, how long they can survive. We intend to do a larger report on this in the next episode. I'm sure many episodes are after to cover the horrible after effects of this. But the other major headline of the week is that possibly the counteroffensive has started. What stage that counteroffensive may be in, who knows, but there has been a major offensive push immediately south of Zaporizhia City in the Ordakhivka direction against Russian lines. And of course, in Belgorod region, we are talking about how these pro-Ukraine Russian volunteers did the raid beforehand that we talked about. Well, these raids have continued, and as I'm currently speaking, there is a strip of territory within Russia that is effectively under Ukrainian control, a small one, but it does exist. But without any further ado, here is our interview with Dylan Burns. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, everyone. This week on the program, we are interviewing Dylan Burns, a political streamer who has done quite a lot of on-the-ground reporting from Ukraine. Dylan, can you introduce yourself in your own words?
Hello. I'm Dylan Burns. I am a political streamer and upstart war journalist. I got my start when I was very young, when I was 18, streaming on Twitch, talking to people about the election, about, you know, all of the political tension in the United States right now between Democrats, Republicans, a lot of the protest movements going on in the United States. I covered January 6th from on the ground. I also did it while in a Biden hoodie, which got a little bit of attention. I'm mostly known for my Twitch streaming, but as of last year, I've always had a focus on foreign policy. And as of last year, I decided that I was going to go to Ukraine and try to cover the war directly in order to improve the coverage, because I, you know, not only do I care a lot about foreign policy and care a lot about bringing attention to, you know, international crises, famine and war, but I also do believe that the Ukrainian struggle is just, and as much attention that can be brought to it, the better.
Yeah, that's the first thing I actually wanted to talk about, is that in the world of political streaming, YouTubing, that kind of thing, it's often kind of a stay-at-home type job. They have your setup at home, you give your opinion of what's going on, and then you know, back and forth with people. And it's very unusual that these YouTubers, streamers will go do other, like, on the ground reporting of any kind, even within their own neighborhoods, and you came all the way to another continent to do it. So did you have like what led to you wanting to make that jump into being an actual war reporter as opposed to a commentator?
Well, I always had a deep interest in foreign policy. I started gaining that interest while I was in middle school and early high school. I went to a school where you had the ability that you could, you know, between classes, you could work on your computer, you could kind of follow your own interests. And I decided that between classes, the way I would follow my own interests was by following the Syrian Civil War day by day, by using a lot of the open source intel that is now a lot more openly available online. Well, in the war of Ukraine, like open source intel and open source intelligence has become popularized in Syria. This was what a lot of the technologies that is now being used now to make this information widely available to the public. A lot of the information that used to not be widely available during wartime, that first happened during the Syrian Civil War, and I followed it day by day. But I was too young to go to Syria or to expand upon that interest because I was in middle school and early high school. And then once I started political commentary and this war started, I directed a lot of my attention on covering the war online, and I made a decent amount of money doing it. In a month, I made thousands upon thousands of dollars just covering this. And when I looked at all this money I made, and I mean, it's not like tens or 20, 30, but I'm still a decent chunk of change, I thought about how I could use this money to better improve my coverage, since a lot of people were seemingly coming to me to ask my opinion or get like daily updates about the war. And I decided that, you know, I wasn't having the best time with college at the moment. I was, not able to pay attention. The war was taking up a lot more of my time. I decided I was going to concentrate 100% of my effort on trying to cover the war as best as I could. And ever since then, I've become really attached to this type of work. While it's hard, it's weird to say it, I do enjoy this type of work. I get a lot of fulfillment out of this type of work. And I believe my personal responsibility is to capture as much as possible. So, you know, 20, 30, 40 years from now, people could see the perspectives of those on the ground living in Ukraine for an English audience. Because a lot of the people that I'm talking to, while there are existing interviews out there of, deminers or of, soldiers on the front line or of, volunteers, a lot of it has not been translated into English. And that's what I'm primarily interested in, is not only documenting this for historical purposes, but also making sure that those who are, very interested in this internationally can listen to the people who are affected by this war directly, outside of just like a CNN host telling them what somebody else thinks, when you could just listen to them directly with a simple translation.
Yeah, on that point, I think it's really interesting how a lot of the people in your field have these like very massive followings, people they're able to get a hold of, people who listen to them when they speak, partially because it comes from, the more political commentary side, which does bring in more eyes and ears. It's just that simple. But also, we're talking about an audience that is much younger than traditional journalism tends to be. So do you try to, when you are doing your journalism, do you try to do it straight, like the same as any other journalist would? Tends to get their information from sources like yours, as opposed to sources like CNN. Do you make any adjustments for that?
So in my opinion, I think one of the strongest attributes of my work is the fact that it has gotten young people interested. Now, to me, I'm still quite young. I'm 22. So young people to me means your like peers. Somebody 18, 19. Yeah. It generally means my peers. And even though I'm very old at heart, I really like, old Western movies, and I don't consider myself the most hip. I am still young enough to know generally how to communicate with people my own age, what type of media forms do they use to gather news and information. Twitter is something that young people a lot of times use to gather news and information. You got to find young people where they are. And on these streaming platforms like YouTube and Twitch, this is where a lot of definitely young Gen Zers are getting their updates about the news. A lot less of them are tuning into MSNBC. A lot less of them are tuning into CNN. And I really don't want to see this new generation of people getting interested in world affairs, getting sucked into the YouTube algorithm, or not as much the Twitch algorithm, but getting sucked into the YouTube algorithm and being completely at the mercy of just whatever the YouTube system decides they're going to put in front of them. Because you can get into some really crazy rabbit holes jumping down the YouTube algorithm. So I want to make sure that there's as much direct source information as possible for this young English-speaking community,
so they can make the most informed decisions about what they think of the war and whether to continue supporting aid, et cetera, which I, of course, am personally supportive of.
Right. I remember the first at least few weeks of the war when whenever there'd be any kind of, well, before the war, there was basically nothing on Ukraine on YouTube. I remember trying to look it up and there'd be stuff like in Ukrainian, like travel videos and stuff in Ukrainian about that. But most of the stuff in English was like weird sexpat stuff about how do you date women in Kyiv, like who are the best like dating agencies and like that kind of creepy stuff. So really any kind of content about Ukraine that's actually useful and informational was very low key. Romeo and I both used to work at a TV station, for example, that posted a lot on YouTube and did not get like the massive numbers of views that you would have thought we would have considering the fact that we're at, you know, a major channel. But now, of course, that's all different. And whereas at the beginning of the war, there's this issue of any kind of coverage, any kind of anything about Ukraine, that algorithm would then feed you into something like really dumb. Like for me, it was that Mearsheimer speech, that very famous Mearsheimer speech.
27 million views.
Is that Mearsheimer's, every time I would let a video about Ukraine play on, it would shift to that Mearsheimer speech, where he explained how America is like egging Russia on to invade, and everyone pointed out, see, Mearsheimer told it how it was back then, even though it's all complete nonsense. And I hope any of our listeners would understand why it's nonsense by now. So I guess my thoughts on that are like, do you have people reaching out to you at all, other YouTube creators who are open to hearing about Ukraine or at least speaking about it in a better way?
That John Mearsheimer speech, I am working on something about John Mearsheimer and about his work right now. I'm working on it with a friend of mine. But when you watch his speech, well, a lot of people point to it as an example of, wow, look how right he was ahead of the curve. He makes multiple predictions during that speech that are just completely off base. I think the most obvious one being saying that Putin will not invade Ukraine because it's such a crazy idea and he's just too smart for that, right? And I feel like if you're getting such fundamental predictions wrong, there might be something else deeper about your foreign policy worldview that might also be flawed. It'd be one thing if he said he most likely won't invade, but when you guarantee it, like it's not going to happen.
Black and white,
that's the problem.
And you're being a lot more charitable to Mearsheimer than I suspect I typically would.
I'm trying to be a nice guy, okay? I'm trying to be a decent person. But I really do believe that if we do not get more aggressive about making sure that Ukrainians are centered in these conversations, making sure that they're able to talk about their experiences directly, and doing our best to communicate those directly to English speakers, we're going to allow false narratives that are easily provably false to dominate. Something that I remember hearing all the time is, well, why did they ban the Russian language in Ukraine? This is something I would hear constantly before I came to Ukraine, that I come to Ukraine and I meet people in Kyiv. I meet people literally on the front line, many of whom are speaking Russian, and they're speaking Russian openly. But from the narratives that I heard online before I came here, I was led to believe I was going to enter the country and I was going to see like signs everywhere that says like, no Russian, you're not allowed to speak it. And these are just the types of things that the type of experiences and the type of things you find out that you can only communicate directly to them through these firsthand experiences, through talking to these people directly. And it's one of the easiest ways to disprove it by just going here, putting the camera in front of people and having them, hey, look, this person is speaking Russian in this interview. Looks like it isn't banned. Hey, look, you know all those rumors about what happened during Euromaidan? Let's talk directly to a Euromaidan protester. And that type of conversation hasn't been had in 9 years about Euromaidan protesters. And I think reopening those conversations are also very important because people are just checking into the war. And a lot of people weren't paying attention during Euromaidan, paying attention during the protest movement. And so sitting down and fleshing out this history with people is so, so, so important, especially, again, on YouTube, on Twitch,
in these spaces in alt media spheres where the most dominant theories, the most dominant narratives are going to be the ones that are the most James Bondy or sound most like they're coming out of a, you know, an action novel.
Outrage bait. Like what drives the algorithms is outrage bait. And if you say something wild and crazy that gets people angry and makes it so people say, have you seen this shit? Come look at this video. How like everything's secretly awful and we're all being controlled. Like that's the kind of thing that drives the clicks, unfortunately.
It's a lot easier to say like, hey, look, this is just like a Tom Clancy novel. You should look at this. America organized a coup in Kiev, than say, hey, actually, that guy, you know, maybe, you know, he kind of murdered some protesters and he tried to outlaw protesting and it actually pushed the people to its limit. Treating Ukrainians like they have autonomy is difficult for a lot of the, you know, the armchair analysts in the West.
Right. So getting back to my question, though, have you worked with other YouTubers? Because I guess the thing here is the thing I'm most fascinated with you is your kind of crossover between these two worlds of traditional journalism and the YouTube streaming and all that. And you have gotten a pretty good response from like the journalist community in Ukraine. We've talked to a lot of the same people. Actually, you did an interview with Jim, our mutual friend. But I was wondering more so on the YouTube side of things and the streamer side of things, if you've been able to do anything to convince other people to cover it in a better way.
It's hard to say exactly how much of an influence I have directly been. I do know that there are certain people that I've interviewed and certain people that I highlighted that are now more active online in the online space and showing a Ukrainian perspective. There was this one person that I interviewed called Anastasia, who was a Euromaidan protester in Kharkiv. And her father was murdered by the Russian army late last year in a Grad rocket strike while he was sitting on this porch. And by interviewing her and highlighting her perspective, not only was she able to raise a lot of money for a lot of the local units and food banks that are still operating out of Kharkiv, but she was able to build connections with other streamers much larger than me, where she could then sit down and just talk about the day-to-day life, what it's like to live in a city that is constantly being bombed. Why she participated in Euromaidan, why she supports Ukrainian independence, why she thinks the liberation of all of the territory is so important. Well, how the war has affected her and her family directly. And she gets to go to people, not only develop these personal relationships with other streamers, so they feel like at any point they could just DM her and ask her, hey, what's up? But that there's also a catalog of interviews that I have that any streamer could use and sit down and watch to get a better idea of what it means for these people who are experiencing the war directly. I think these types of relationships with streamers are building personal connections with those on the ground here. That's the type of stuff that I think can really, really, really improve coverage. And you don't even need to, you know, go to any YouTube video or find somebody online to do it. You could you could find people on the ground experiencing this war, just talk to them directly about their experiences to better understand the conflict. On any number of platforms outside of what I'm doing. But I think that's something that I'm most proud of about my work, that I've been able to do that, has been able to bridge this divide.
Yeah. And I think part of that is not relying on the currently established online content creation community, but trying to get more Ukrainians into it. There've been a few of them who got pretty big on TikTok, especially seems to be the preferred platform for a lot of these. But one of the issues is just that there is a shortage of people who speak English on a very fluent level, so that could hold them back. But it would be interesting to see how much crossover there can be there of allowing these Ukrainian creators to kind of get out into the world war, like you said with your friend Anastasia. I guess one question I have for you also is, because you're so young, did you do much international travel before this? I think that's an interesting one.
I went deep into the Canadian wilderness by crossing the border onto the Canadian side of Niagara Falls once. Outside of that, no. I'm very young. I spent most of my time in my home state of Maryland growing up. For me, this has been an extremely transformative experience, both personally and growing my horizons, but also just, you know, expanding my comfort zone, because I really love my home state of Maryland. I really hate leaving it for any extended period of time.
Yeah, as someone who lives directly on the Canadian border, Canada is not a foreign country.
America's hat.
I feel more camaraderie with my Canadian comrades on the immediate other side of the border, because we're all the Detroit area. The Detroit area extends pretty far into Ontario as well. So because this is one of your first kind of big thing out into the broader world, I was wondering, like, was there anything about Ukraine that you found particularly interesting or surprising, war or not?
I guess growing up in Maryland, growing up in the United States, the architecture is very different. And it's extremely, it's an extremely gigantic country. I think a lot of people don't realize how gigantic Ukraine really is in comparison to a lot of other European states, or even just like American states. While, of course, America is larger, you usually don't drive across the entirety of the United States. And driving across the entirety of Ukraine and seeing the difference between Lviv and Kharkiv and how they treat their infrastructure, the old Soviet commie blocks, and the more European urbanist, like, kind of the way Lviv is designed, is very, it's a lot more European style, a lot closer to what a lot of Polish cities look like. Extremely diverse, not how it's often portrayed in the media. One of the things that actually I think grabbed me the most, and I've said this to other people, and other Americans have shared the sentiment, but when I was growing up, I was under the impression that borscht was a single turnip and some like hot water. It was like the poor man's food, and I think this perception was built during the Soviet Union, because the idea was like, this is what the people in Soviet Union eat. You know, the people in Russia, the people in Ukraine, Soviet Union's poor, they're communist. Therefore, borscht is like a tiny turnip and some cold water. But actually coming here and being able to eat borscht and being able to experience these things directly, I was like, oh, this actually has meat in it. It actually has a lot more depth to it. I was given more of a cultural tour than just like the little dilution you get on Family Guy, which was extremely nice.
Yeah, there's a documentary on Netflix now about borscht. I haven't watched it yet, but I keep looking at, like, I'm going to watch you soon. There's regional differences to it. Okay, behind the scenes here, fourth wall breaking. Romeo, I've never even told you this. I have a idea in my brain for bonus content for this show that involves much more food related stuff.
I love food.
Yeah,
I'm 100%.
I kind of want to also do like a rip off of Hot Ones, but with like Ukrainian hot sauces or like vodka.
I mean, we have a decent amount of hot sauce producers down in Ukraine.
I want to do some kind of game show where if you get a question wrong, you have to do a shot of Horilka or like some kind of liquor, and then by the end people are just dead. I think that would be funny.
But we could do a live show. That's something podcasters do.
Yeah, that's right? Something
Trash Taste people did a live show.
Yeah,
they did a whole tour. We can do a live show.
A live show with alcohol. That can't go wrong.
Yeah. Drunk streams always get tons of views.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. This is just something that's usually out of the journalist wheelhouse. But now that Dylan's here, we can ask him how to break into like fun content that people actually enjoy watching.
Like the College Humor guys, right? They have some game show program. It always pops up on YouTube.
Yeah, they expanded into a bunch of game shows.
On there.
I love the College Humor guys. They've gotten a lot of better with time. Actually, I like their D&D stuff. They're a lot of the more personal stuff now. I don't think anybody even watches their skits anymore.
Yeah, I only just watch the. Anyway, this is unrelated.
Yeah, whatever.
Get back to the interview, guys.
I'm leaving this in though. But so then my question. I'm sorry. My brain drifted there as well.
There's one other thing that I think I want to get across. It's something that I experienced personally that I think had the biggest impact on me. I was led to believe, and this is from, I think how the way the Western press sometimes covered the war, that if you were a Russian speaker, you supported Russia. And if you spoke Ukrainian, then you supported Ukraine. And the way that the media, sometimes both sides of the war, definitely in the 8 to 9 years leading up to the war and how they presented it. And I felt that they kind of either just out of, an interest in being journalistically fair or out of just trying to pad time. It made it seem a lot more like if you spoke Russian, this is the way you are. If you spoke Ukrainian, this is the way you are. John Mearsheimer, for example, presented it that way during his 27 million viewed YouTube video where he was showing like the demographic graphs. And so, well, actually, this part of the country is a lot more favorable to majority Russian because they speak Russian. But then I go to Donetsk. I go to these regions that are supposedly hot spots of separatism. And everybody I meet speak Russian. But also everybody I'm meeting, the vast majority of them, are soldiers fighting against the Russian invasion, right? And that type of dynamic where you can speak Russian and be and not want to be part of Russia, while that seems obvious once you've been here and you've talked to people before you come here, I think that that part hasn't been communicated enough. There's a lot of Irish people who speak English who don't want to be part of England, but somehow that same dynamic is applied to Ukraine and it's kind of harder for people to understand.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in former British colonies who do speak English and still fought a lot of wars against England. We come from a country that speaks English and fought a war against Britain on two separate occasions. And I don't know how people with our own historical cultural background can't understand that. We've talked about it on the show, basically, how this was our theory of Iraq war brain, where we got this thing hammered into our brains through media, through the conflicts of the late 20th, early 21st centuries of basically sectarianism being the absolute rule. And if you're part of this ethnic group or this religious group, that automatically means you're on this political side. And that's just not how the world often works.
I also want to mention that it's in large part due to the fact that Russia isn't seen as a colonial power. Like, that's not the accepted mainstream narrative of Russian emergence and Russian influence in the world. It's not as a colonial power, but somehow, despite literally being an empire, always being put upon or harassed by the Western imperialists. Not really sure how that squares with Russia literally having empire in its name, then being an even bigger empire and now trying to regain its imperial ambitions. But that's the narrative.
The interesting thing about that, too, is if you listen to Russian media or the Russian government, it's not like they're pretending to not be an empire and not believe that empire is about a big part of their identity. Every once in a while, you'll see like a Russian foreign ministry post about, you know, Russian anti-colonialist struggle in Africa. But on Russian state media and amongst the Russian government, they're very open about the fact that Russia deserves an empire because they're large, they're powerful, and therefore they come with an empire. That's a narrative that they're very open about expressing to their domestic audience, maybe not as much to, you know, the international audience.
Which gets into that divide between a lot of there not being much linguistic crossover between the ways people cover the war, whereas in Ukraine, people who do speak Russian, you know, fluently, as oftentimes their first language, are very well aware of Russian intentions, whereas it just doesn't cross over so much into the English language reporting, which is like what you were saying, like this problem of a lot like the coverage of the war being so fragmented between what language you speak.
Oh, and the Russian government takes advantage of that. If you look at what they broadcast on Russia Today for an English speaking audience, and you compare that to what they broadcast on their domestic state run TV news channels, the coverage is light and day. While on Russia Today, they might concentrate on like American politicians and American political corruption. It might even be a little bit more overall sensible or a little bit more connected to reality. It's because this has to exist outside of the information capture that much of Russian state TV is able to exist within inside Russian society. On Russian TV, you can't do a broadcast and say, hey, you know, the Ukrainian government wasn't good, and also the war is wrong, and they're wasting all of it. You can't say that on Russian state TV. You can say that in the West, and that's what Russia Today has to exist with it. But then when you go to Russian state TV domestically within Russia, you get everything unfiltered. You get the racism towards Ukrainians unfiltered, endorsed by the Russian state. You get open requests for war crimes and targeting civilians, destroying cities block by block. That was something Solonev talked about, purposely trying to institute mass displacements of people and refugees, open discussion of striking nuclear armed states like France and Germany and trying to bomb them, which would be, of course, something that could kick off Article 5 and start World War III. It's crazy dialogue, but it's regularly talked about on Russian state TV. But they only make that for the domestic audience. And that's why I think the work of people like Julia Davis or translated and those going out there and translating what the Russians say, as in the Russian government, into English is so important. Don't just allow them to just fragment and give you this type of picture perfect version of their narrative meant for you, the English speaking audience. Go look at what they say when you're not supposed to be paying attention.
It's absolutely absurd how this doesn't cross over when even the English language outlets based out of Ukraine are shouting it. So it's not just a matter of language. It's a matter of, you know, listening to the people actually here versus those not. But I do want to get into some of your own coverage. For this recent trip that you've made, you've been doing a lot of work with demining. Can you speak on that a bit?
Yeah, so I spent about a month in the Kharkiv Oblast with the demining crew. I not only filmed with them for about a month, that means going out into the field with them as they did demining work, but I also in large part live with them. That means I ate dinner with them. I usually slept in the same building as them. And I really got to know a lot of these guys. And what I've discovered through my process of filming with them is not only that I have a deeper personal interest in this. Originally, it was only supposed to be a week, but it transformed into a month. But the demining issue in Ukraine is going to be one of the most long-term and important humanitarian issues post this war, once this war is all wrapped up, for decades to come. The projections that I am getting from deminers and from people who are experts in the field, NGOs, both those who are public and those who have no visibility contracts and are not public, is that this is going to be an issue probably for the next 70 to 100 years. And the 70-year prediction, that was if the war ended 4 months ago. And so I think a lot of people don't really realize how intense the issue is, because they're not just dealing with the bombs and explosives from this war. They're dealing with the bombs and explosives from World War One and World War Two, which demining crews have had to been removing from Ukrainian soil from before this war even started, before 2014. They've had to deal with the last 8 to 9 years of bombing and cluster munitions use in the Donbass, as well as now a year and a half of the intense fighting across the entirety of the country. Anti-tank mines, anti-personnel mines, cluster munitions, and a lot of unexploded Soviet munitions. And that is one of the bigger contributors, I think, is that a lot of these Soviet munitions don't go off, either because they're just in a lot of cases extremely old, or I think that's really the main reason a lot of them aren't going off, is because they're extremely old. They've been sitting in storehouses for like 50, 60 years now. They're rusty, they're not good. And so when they're used, they don't explode. And now a lot of them are just sitting in the soil, buried in the countryside, only to be discovered once somebody's tractor or car rolls over it, exploding and kills some local civilian. And so this issue is gigantic in scale. And it's going to take probably longer than my lifetime for it to be dealt with.
Yeah, like in France, every once in a while, there'll still be a farmer that, you know, finds an unexploded artillery shell or something from World War One. Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia are still like horrifically polluted with landmines. It's a global problem, and these are often places to not see the same scale of conventional war that Ukraine is seeing right now, and compared to some places that have been dealing with mine cleanup for decades, there's more mines in Ukraine than there. So I can't even imagine trying to go to some of these locations 2 generations from now and have someone be killed. And then this morning, just again, fourth wall break, we're recording on it on Tuesday, which is the day that we got news of Kakhovka Dam being destroyed and washing a lot of everything downstream, down the Dnipro River, which included a lot of mines. So we're seeing, so like the minefields along the banks of the river that the Russians put to kind of stop any Ukrainian advance there now being washed downstream, any mines that were in the water being carried away. And we're seeing videos of explosions on the banks of the river of when these mines are, you know, hitting a rock or something as they're being swept downstream. So that's a whole other problem of them being not just in the ground, where you can at least run a metal detector over it and dig them up that way. But now buried into the sediment of the river itself, there's going to be a ton of them, which horrifies me.
It's scary. It's scary work, too, because I know that the people who are going to be dealing with these explosives, the vast majority of them do not have the length of training that somebody in a country that traditionally deals with this issue, let's say a Western trainer or any other country, gets. The average Ukrainian D-miner right now is getting about a month of training before going out in the field. Before the war, we're talking 6 months. They now run them through a rapid course as quick as they can, trying to get as much information into them as they can before sending them out in the field to do a lot of demining work. And they're going to learn a lot of stuff, a lot of techniques, a lot of what they're dealing with out in the field. And this is all while they're dealing with one of the most mined countries, one of the biggest catastrophes, humanitarian catastrophes, when it comes to mines and demining in the world today. I mean, when we talk about like keeping track of these bombs, this flood is just one example of how exactly this situation get even further out of control. But let me give you another example. While a lot of people talk about the Russian bombs and the Russian explosives, and that's 90% of the issue, the Ukrainians are also using mines. The Ukrainians are also using bombs. And one issue that I was told by one of the new miners is that, let's say that you're a Ukrainian sapper, you go out and you lay a bunch of anti-tank mines in order to stop the Russian advance, and then you get killed. And after you're killed, who's going to remember where you put all your bombs? Who's going to remember where you put all the mines? And now that issue is not only been added to with the amount of mines and bombs that are in the country, but now they don't even know exactly where they are. And so they now have to go do the work of finding, of retracing that deminer's steps while he's dead, trying to figure out that sapper's steps while he's dead, trying to figure out exactly where he placed all the mines, where he placed all the explosives. And now add these mines just being washed away by a general flood to be spread amongst the Kherson countryside. This is a gigantic disaster, and Ukraine needs a lot more aid in order to deal with this issue, because a lot of areas they know is mined and they just can't do anything because their resources are stretched so thin. They have around 5,000 deminers for the entirety of the country, and that's being generous with the estimate.
During the siege of Kyiv, the immediate surroundings of the city were mined. So a lot of, on the side of the roads, for example, there'd always be a sign that says, you know, danger, mine, don't go here. But they were able to clean, I assume, most of those up. Most of the Ukrainian placed mines around Kyiv were removed, and there's not that there's not those signs anymore saying, do not go here or you'll die. So that's the kind of ideal scenario of, you place a mine, you know where that mine is, you remove it later when it's no longer needed. But as you said, like, a lot of these places are being mined for such a long time. And what happens if the information of where they are doesn't exist anymore, even if you're following best practices?
And the Soviets, the Russians certainly aren't going to tell you where they placed a mine, even when the war's over.
Oh, absolutely not. They have. According to the rules, after they had left Kyiv Oblast, after they left Chernihiv, Sumy, they were supposed to hand over information of where these minefields were, according to like the most strict understanding of the rules of war there. But of course, that didn't happen. And in actuality, there were improvised explosive devices left behind and children's toys deliberately left behind to kill kids. So it's not just in the ground. We're talking, go home, open the door. The door was, there's a trip wire at the door. And now what you thought you finally had the opportunity to go home safe, now you're missing an arm at best.
I mean, we've seen video evidence and photo evidence of mines being placed inside of pianos, of being placed inside children's rooms, of animals being mined, of of civilian homes being mined. I have been there with the demining crews as they're driving home, and a civilian will like wave them down, and they'll be like, "Ah, yeah, there's like five mines, like 50 to 100 feet from my home in my backyard. Can you please remove it before somebody gets killed?" And then they have to make the split second decision if they're going to help this person off the books or not, because technically they have to call like a phone line and they have to, you know, get it officially registered for them to come over and help them. But when you realize how unbelievably strained the deminers are, it could be a lot of them feel if they were to go through this official process will be very hit or miss. And so it's up to the demining crew if they're going to, you know, deviate and help them. And in my experience, 99% of the time, if you're working with the good guys that I was working with, at least they deviate, they take some time out of their day, and they're going to help demine those yards. But that is not enough to deal with the scale of the issue when you realize how many civilian homes have these explosives unbelievably close to them. I mean, I saw like PMF-1 anti-personnel mines, butterfly mines. These are mines that the Soviet Union has been using for a very long time. It was used during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. It became very notorious because Afghan children would not know that they were mines because they look very much like toys. They'd be picked up by children and they would blow off their arm or blow off their leg and permanently maim these young Afghans. And now that same issue is being ran into right now in Ukraine with these PMF-1 landmines being within like 20 to 25 feet of civilian homes, some of which have children. And so this just shows like exactly how unbelievably bad the situation is right now, that there's the resources are stretched so thin that it's been months in a lot of this liberated territory and they're still finding these mines, and they're going to be finding these mines in liberated territory for years and years, years and years to come. And it's only going to come with trial and error and just stumbling upon this. A lot of the times it's because they find out about these mines because an animal blows up and they'll just hear it in the distance, or like a dog will run over a PMF-1 or some other mine, an anti-personnel mine, and they'll be informed of a new minefield. And that type of stuff's happening all the time. They'll find out about a new minefield or a new area that's mined because an animal blew up. And that's actually one of the main identifiers. I guess you could call it like a canary in the coal mine.
Or in this case, a cow in the
cow in the wheat field. Usually a dog. It's usually dogs. When I was filming with them, we stumbled upon a few dogs that had been killed by anti-personnel mines.
I don't want to talk about the dead dogs right now. So have you, what are some other big stories that you've worked on? Because you've been to Ukraine a few times now, and the demining thing was your main focus this time around. But what are some other big stories that you worked on in country?
I did a big piece on Starlink and how Starlinks were getting delivered across the country. A lot of it was not this formal, like a very like organized process, but required a lot of volunteer workers kind of, you know, volunteering time out of their day, a lot of informal relationships. And for my time, you know, covering the Starlink deliveries and how useful Starlink has been, it's an unbelievably wild story. It started on Twitter from a Twitter interaction between a Ukrainian government official and Elon Musk 2 days into the war. It was organized very haphazardly, not a lot of time for a review amongst the civilian population of Ukraine, which is understandable. They're getting invaded. It's a horrific war. They need to get as much supporting infrastructure in place for Ukrainian communications as possible, and Starlink was part of that. But due to how quick everything happened during those early days, there was not a lot of discussion about long-term contracts, what exactly the relationship between the Ukrainian government and Elon Musk Starlink was going to be. And so in these questions of, wait, what does Elon actually believe about the war? What does he think about Eastern Ukraine? What does he think about the elections with Viktor Yanukovych? What does he think about Crimea? He doesn't believe the Ukrainians should take it back. And now there's questions on whether or not he'll allow Starlink to be used in locations like Crimea. All those questions didn't get asked in those early days. And because of these lack of contracts, these lack of formal relationships due to how quickly everything just kind of like fell into place because of the war. And so I dug into these questions, the deeper questions of, well, what does Elon Musk actually believe about these things? What is the risk of him just pulling Starlink out from under the support from under the Ukrainians, right out from under them, due to these personal beliefs? how has Starlink contributed to Ukraine's defense, and about the, you know, reports of outages of Starlink, which Starlink has been used by these soldiers on the front line to support them for communication, and the idea that Starlink could go out in the middle of a battle so they can no longer communicate with their command. That's very scary, and I wanted to investigate those reports. I did a video about it. I was very proud of that video.
Yeah, it seems in most cases, Elon is such an inconsistent and unreliable person that even when he was declaring how unreliable he would be, even that turned out to be unreliable, where he would say that he basically said that a lot of these Starlinks would be in large part completely shut down. And then that happened to a much more minimal degree than how he made it sound. It's just, it's so crazy how unreliable he is, even when it comes to being unreliable.
I really just wish that Elon Musk stayed on the path that he was on 2 days into the war when it comes to, you know, we're giving broad support. I understand him wanting to make sure that he's financially compensated or at least covered for how much money's being spent to support Ukraine with Starlink. Trust me, they are being financially compensated. I really just wish he stuck to what he was good at, the tech stuff, the science stuff. Well, supposedly what he's good at, if you look at Twitter, maybe not always with the tech stuff, but usually with the science stuff, usually with the tech stuff, he's good at that. When he starts delving into the history, when he starts doing this kind of like pop history, which I have no clue where he's getting these conclusions based upon. For example, something that really aggravated me was he talked about the 2012 election results in Ukraine. And he tried to use Viktor Yanukovych winning majorities in eastern Ukraine as proof that the majority of eastern Ukrainians don't want to be part of Ukraine. Now, I do not think it is honest to say just because somebody voted for Viktor Yanukovych, that necessarily means they don't want to be part of Ukraine. They were voting for a Ukrainian president who at the time said that he was a Ukrainian patriot who wanted the country to stay in one piece. That was his platform. Not to mention, in the 2 years between 2012 and 2014, a lot happened in Ukrainian society that affected public opinion and how Viktor Yanukovych was viewed, that led to him even fleeing the country with his tail between his legs. And I don't think that type of historical context is given when Elon Musk analyzes the situation in his Twitter threads.
And Yanukovych ran on a European integration platform, and might not happen because he deviated from his election promises. But speaking of assholes on the internet, that's my segue there. You've done some debates with people who are not so friendly with Ukraine. I can get into some of the questions about the efficacies of that in a bit. But first, I want to ask you, can you describe some of the people you've debated, and how did that go? Like, what are your general takeaways of?
Well, I've debated, Jackson Hinkle, who's a, been a guest on like Russian state television. Somebody who, you know, was a speaker at a Rage Against the War Machine, at the Rage Against the War Machine rally. I've spoken to a lot of the more run of the mill supporters of the invasion, people who are more maybe not supportive of the Russian invasion in question, but they are against aid for either, you know, financial reasons or, you know, anti-interventionist reasons. I've talked to just about somebody representing every perspective you can imagine on this war. I've probably had more than like 20 debates about Ukraine or issues surrounding Ukraine. I've had a lot.
But in any of these debates, do you think like you've changed many minds? Do you think that you kind of spread the good word to some of the audiences of people who would not readily self-identify as being pro-Russia, even if we could make that accusation of them, but people who are more fence riders? Do you think you've really made headway with any of those people from
these states? I like to think so. I have, you know, personal anecdotes of people sending me DMs on Twitter and people sending me emails on my, you know, my business email account for my YouTube channel, saying that, you know, before they didn't really care about Ukraine. Before this conversation I had with somebody that they used to watch, they used to buy into everything, you know, the idea that it was all a CIA coup, etc. And then after watching one of the conversations, they were like, oh, you know, he asked some questions that the person I was watching didn't have answers for. And so they go and they either Google it themselves, or maybe they go look at my other content covering these types of issues. and it can convert a few people, get some people over. Hearts and minds is the idea. Certain communities, you're going to have a lot more success than others. I had a debate with a dating coach, a red pill dating coach, about 3 weeks ago on the issue of Ukraine. And I got a very positive response from his community in my DMs and in my email, saying that, you know, that I actually had an impact on them when it comes to bringing them over to the pro-Ukraine side. And I think the reason was is because the community he isn't built upon, you know, denying the existence of Ukrainians. It isn't built upon denying, you know, Ukrainian suffering or advocating for the Russian invasion. I doubt a lot of times if I was to go onto a Russian state media platform and do the same thing, that I could have the same impact, because the environment was just better tuned, since it wasn't built explicitly to, you know, support the invasion or to, you know, put out Russian state propaganda, that I had more open ears and a lot more open minds. It's all about making sure, though, that you don't treat the audience like they're stupid, even if the person you're talking to in a conversation is stupid.
Right. This raises a big question that is around a lot in the online creative space in general, but also is very popular in Ukraine, this idea of no platforming, of people who are hazardous. I don't know how many of the people he would have debated would be in, like, you know, the beyond redemption category. Hinkle definitely is. He's horrible. But if there's this idea of, by giving them space to speak, by allowing it to be in a debate, you then treat their position as something debatable and therefore, like, respectable to have in a conversation. And also, by having this debate, you then give them more of an audience that they would not have had beforehand. I waffle a bit on this idea. I think that it is applicable in a lot of situations. But then, for example, after your discussion with... So I think, for example, after some of your discussions with Michael Tracy, a.k.a. the Butter Goblin, the things he said, he handled himself so poorly in some of your discussions with him that the clips of this were kind of shared around to kind of highlight the absurdity of his position. So I guess... You can start off, like, what's your general thoughts on this no platform?
Well, I think the Michael Tracy conversation is a great example of why I want to have these conversations in the first place. Not only is talking to Michael Tracy very different than talking to a Russian propagandist, because I don't think he's the same as a Russian propagandist. I think the logic of his positions once put to the test on what exactly conditions would he accept. He would support Ukraine. If Ukraine was facing a genocide, would he then say Ukraine has to win? And once you put these questions to him and you put it under the microscope and you get him to answer these tough questions, a lot of these tough questions, when the cursory observer will see it, they'll be surprised at exactly how far a lot of people are willing to allow Ukraine to be trampled upon before wanting to respond with force at all. While some people might look at Michael Tracy's position as, you know, respectable restraint, I would say that it is contemptible inaction when it comes to his inability to want to respond to the Russian aggression on Ukraine with aid and through empowering Ukraine to defend itself. And so I think through these conversations, a lot of people can kind of start to see not only the flaws in Michael Tracy's logic, but a lot of the logic underpinning the anti-Ukraine, the anti-aid to Ukraine movement. And that's part of the reason why I want to have these conversations, is not only to, like, quote unquote, expose Michael Tracy, because the reason I talked to Michael Tracy wasn't, I didn't, like, set out to, like, embarrass this person or do anything like that. It was to have a conversation about these ideas and empower the people who are watching my show when they engage with these ideas in the future, think, oh, I remember hearing something similar to that on this show. But I remember when we examined this idea, we found out that actually that isn't true. Or we found out that actually, if we take it to its logical conclusion, it wouldn't really make that much sense. And I think this not only empowers people to engage with these ideas better themselves, but it allows us to put those who are against aid to the test, and put them to the test in front of their audience and in front of a larger audience that they might not be exposed to. For example, I think having these types of debates on third party platforms, for example, a friend of mine, James from Modern Day Debates, he hosts a ton of debates on his platform. That can be extremely useful as well.
Now, don't you think that there is the risk of these people just lying to seem more reasonable instead of presenting their actual positions? Or what is a very common conversational tool is the Mott and Bailey, where they will make some vague and outlandish, crazy claim, and then you press down to it. Oh, it turns out that it's actually really reasonable and modest if you think about it. And this way they can build legitimacy with these audiences.
For me, I never host a conversation under the idea that I'm going to convince the other person ever. I always only host these conversations under the idea that I want to have an impact on the people watching, never the other person that I'm talking to. And so that comes with the assumption that sometimes the person you're talking to might not be communicating with you in the best of faith. They might be lying. They might be being purposely dishonest. They might not be mentioning something that would add a lot more context and might undermine their point. And so that's part of the reason why I believe that if you're going to have these types of conversations, you need to be prepared. I've seen a lot of people go into conversations and I've seen them be lied to about Ukraine, stuff like, you know, the CIA overthrew the Ukrainian government or some any number one of these lies. And because they weren't prepared or they were working under the assumption that the person they were talking to was working in good faith, even though many times I'll engage with people who believe these things about the CIA overthrowing the Ukrainian government, it's not even dishonest. They just genuinely believe it. They read a headline somewhere else or somebody else lied to them. And now they're continuing that lie unknowingly. Sometimes they know it's a lie. Sometimes they don't know it's a lie. Either way, you have to confront it the same way by holding the person down and asking them for proof, asking them for evidence, asking them to elaborate on that, pressing them on things that you know is a lie, and showing them to be unknowledgeable about the topic. And if somebody is exposed to be unknowledgeable about the topic, it's going to make it a lot harder for them to try to convince unsuspecting people in the future. If that person's first interaction with them is, oh, they lied about this or they misrepresented this.
Yeah, the way I see it is that basically there's the rules of dealing with trolls on the internet, and there's two ways to deal with trolls. One, you just ignore them, which works, I think, most of the time. But the other is to kind of get them to actually explain themselves. And in the process of doing so, if they talk long enough, eventually they unravel everything, in my experience. The question I always ask people who either outright support Russia or more often want to get rid of aid to Ukraine, you just have to ask them, what do you think will happen if Ukraine does not receive military aid, and get them to actually defend what that kind of scenario would play out. And usually they just kind of will end the conversation there in the form of, oh, then there'll be peace talks. And then you can't just say, and then what? Like there's a way to, I guess, press the argument to actually play out rather than just rely on vagaries and slogans.
I understand why people are against having conversations with some of these people, definitely the more dishonest actors. I understand that people don't want to see these narratives pushed on bigger platforms, and they don't want to see people who are dishonestly using Ukrainian suffering against them or misrepresenting Ukrainian suffering. They don't want to see those types of people succeed or become dominant in the information space. But I also want people to understand that this conversation, this debate about aid to Ukraine is going to happen whether or not I end up sitting down with these people to debate them on whether or not Ukraine should be getting aid or debate them about any of the specifics of the war. We're seeing it happen right now on the presidential debate stage. We're seeing it with Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis, Vivek Ramaswamy, Nikki Haley, Mike Pence, Tim Scott, Ron DeSantis, all these people. We're seeing this debate manifest not only within the internet scene, you know, online between all these internet commentators and armchair analysts, but also within the political scene, not only with presidential candidates, but also with congressmen and senators as well, with, I think, Mike Lee, Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert.
And they are bringing this conversation to the forefront. They are trying to bring this conversation about ending aid to the forefront. And if that conversation is going to happen, I would much rather be involved in it than sitting on the sidelines, just passively allowing them to dominate the airwaves with no pushback.
Now, to take a kind of pro deplatforming view here, which you may disagree with a little bit, but my view is that when you give a platform, or when you speak to people who are dishonest liars, people like Hinkle, like Tracy, they're like fascist grifters. They're in it for fame and money, and they have very few values of their own to really care about. So they will pivot to saying whatever they think will make them the most popular at that moment. And when you allow, or you speak to them and they use that conversation as a way to boost their own popularity, as a lot of these more conspiratorial minded GOP Congress people do, you kind of run the risk of simply giving them space to say batshit things. And it doesn't matter whether those batshit things are proven to be false or are proven to be inflammatory or offensive or simply misguided and incorrect. The very fact that they say it reinforces this narrative that they're trying to push. So you're kind of encountering, like, I've worked in disinformation for a long time. Part of, I think, being a journalist in Ukraine is getting a sense of how to handle and fight disinformation. And it seems to me that it is often more effective to let the lunatics scream into the void, then let them scream at the void into your face. Because once they're doing it into your face, people will now associate whatever they're screaming with this conflict of you versus them. And instead of, well, the shit they're saying is batshit.
And I one thing I'd add to that is I see it as kind of the Joe Rogan problem, which is you had a bunch of people who were gibbering maniacs, but then were able to go on the Joe Rogan podcast, like the biggest podcast in the world, and were able to sound relatively human for the duration of that interview, which then led people into thinking that there's something reasonable about them. So if you look at Gavin McGinnis, if you look at Sargon Vakat, I forget his real name, their interviews on Joe Rogan, which is what really made them as popular as they eventually became, they were able to sound reasonable. I'm not going to say reasonable, but basically functioning human enough to get people on what used to be called the pipeline, although that framework has somewhat broken down. So I guess my question there is, even if they're able to string together a reasonable argument or an argument that is able to, they're able to know what could sound okay to your audience and adjust to that. And then if someone goes to hear more of what they have to say is far worse than what shows up on your show.
The most popular news show in the United States up until very recently was Tucker Carlson's program until he got fired, Lamal. Before he got fired, a week before he got fired, he had RFK on, Robert, you know, he's the guy who's running for president. He's not going to be president, but he's running for president. And on Tucker Carlson's new show, he said that for every Russian soldier that dies, 7 Ukrainian soldiers die. Tucker Carlson said the same thing a week before. It's blatant lie, not true, just misinformation through and through. Fox never issued a correction. Tucker never issued a correction. RFK never issued a correction. RFK would go on to suggest that Ukraine had nuclear weapons on Twitter. Tucker Carlson himself has gone on to make similar assertions on his program before he was fired. These types of statements are going to be made and are being made currently, whether or not I decide to go out and debate them. And if they're going to be out there in the information space, there has to be something, some resource, some conversation, something that somebody can access in order to push back against these narratives. And if I can, add anything to the search algorithm. So when somebody looks up Tucker Carlson 7-1 or something, or some misinformation statement that was made, if they could find my video or my information talking about it, saying this is not true, this is complete nonsense, or me confronting somebody over it. And those types of confrontations, by the way, are going to be some of the most effective, I think, when convincing somebody who's engaging with you honestly. Because if somebody is told a piece of misinformation, and instead of just saying, here's me debunking it, but here's me debunking it and then talking to someone who believes it, who is unable to deal with my debunking, it's just going to be more convincing. It's just going to be stronger. And so if these conversations are already happening, if these narratives are already being pumped out into the public space with or without me, I'd rather make sure that either Ukrainians or people who understand the war from a Ukrainian perspective are involved enough so people can hear their perspective. They can hear my perspective, or at least some pushback on these ideas.
So do you have any future plans of what to do in Ukraine, or going back home, coming back to Ukraine after that? Any topics that you are finding especially interesting that you need to dig into? What's the future of you and Ukraine?
Man, I have so much footage and projects that I got to release. I have interviews with Ukrainian soldiers fighting in Bakhmut that I have to release. I got interviews with priests who are leading their own battalions I got to release. I've got so much content I have to release. But it's one thing to go out there and film, and I do like the filming process. But I despise the editing process. I despise the script writing process. I despise everything else. I wish I could just film something, have an idea of what I want it to be like in my head, and then immediately upload it and be done with it. But I can't. So I have a lot of stuff in the works from what I've already filmed. But as for what I want to continue to do out here, I would very much like to have some conversations with military recruiters. That's going to be very difficult, though, to get anybody to sit down for an honest conversation about military recruitment practices in Ukraine.
I'm sorry. The reason you want to hear honesty from a military recruiter?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a hard pitch, but I think it's important because I don't see anything else online or anywhere having long form conversations with these people about what the military recruitment process is like. And from having sit down conversations with military recruiters, it seems that a lot of them suffer from an old Soviet mentality of, well, this is how it's done, so this is how we do it. And a lot of the people who are trying to change the process, they're recruiting a lot less people who are, you know, dead or already out there in a field where they're sending their families letters, even though they've already been sent out to the front. They're getting a lot of pushback, and I would like to cover that. I'd like to do more filming of demining. I'd like to do another month. I'd like to get a lot more interviews with demining crews. And I'd also like to highlight a lot more the political diversity of those who make up the Ukrainian resistance. I recently did an interview with a right sector fighter because there's not a lot of English translated content of talking to these people, even though there's a lot of pontification about, you know, the far right and the nationalists and in Western press and in Russian press. And so I wanted to, you know, make sure that there was some source material on that. But I also want to make sure that I show the full diversity of exactly who's fighting for Ukraine. There's a lot of anarchists that are fighting for Ukraine. There's a lot of liberals who are fighting for Ukraine. There's people all across the political spectrum. And I want to help paint the picture of, if America was invaded, everyone would pick up a gun. Everyone from all different corners of American society, the good and the bad, would end up fighting against the invasion. And the same thing is true about Ukrainian society. It's all of society, all of Ukrainian society engage in active resistance against the invasion. So I'd like to better highlight that in my interviews moving forward. I have a lot of stuff, but I don't want to give up too much of the game. I don't want to give up too much of what I have planned.
Just sneak peek there. But so we'll close this interview off. So do you have any, can you give your plugs, where to find your material?
Sure. If you want to look at my more journalistic content, you can find it at Dylan Burns TV on YouTube. If you want to see my daily stream content, you can find me at Dylan Burns TV on Twitch or Dylan Burns Live, which is my YouTube channel for it, on YouTube for my live content. And if you want to follow my everyday hot takes, you can follow me on Dylan Burns 1776 on Twitter and Dylan Burns TV on Instagram for pictures of my ground coverage here. Thank you very much for having me on, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, great to have you on. And as we close out, Slava Ukraini.
Aram Slava.
That is all we have for you this week. I hope you enjoyed the interview. If you would like to support this podcast, please share us with your friends, your family, on social media. Rate us, review us. And if you would like to support Ukraine more generally, you can go to our link tree in the description. And if you would like to support our podcast financially, you may go to patreon.com/UkraineWithoutHype and join our list of supporters. I just put up a newsletter there for the $10 and up category about visiting Transnistria on Victory Day with pictures. It is a fascinating place. But I would like to now thank our patrons. So thank you all very much to Deborah Grazer, Will Stevens, David Shepard, Dawson, Giorgio, Ivana Kokratskaya, Michael Drucker, Anna Karen Person, Anonymous, Devi, Etienne, Justin Devendorf, Kevin Albritton, Michael Wickman, Mike Barone, Sam Toman, Shieldwall, Adam Poppenheimer, Aiden McDonald, Alex Grochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Big Rob, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Chris Walker, Crystal Burns, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Eric Honnold, Grace Krause, Had to Laugh, Jacob Holm, James Wise, Jenny Louise, Jerd, Julia Lindsay, Laura DeLeon, Levy Grove, Marguerite, Matt Miller, Melissa Koselko, MJ Noster, Anonymous, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, Randy McNerlin, Sanjay, Scott Berry, Scott Gengris, Scott Tuckeryuk, Steve Ben, Stuart Akers, T. Bart, Thomas Sobiek, Veronica, and Victoria Leontineva. Thank you all very much. So until next week, Slava Ukraini!